Blog Talk Radio.
Now, PW Torch and Spreaker bring you the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show. It's time to talk this week's AEW Dynamite on TNT.
Tyler, it is the first Dynamite after a widely praised AEW pay-per-view where, you know, the conclusion among a lot of people is AEW's really good at pay-per-views. How do you think they did as a follow-up to the pay-per-view, emphasizing what happened and moving things forward to the next chapter?
Yeah, I think on the whole, I was positive on it tonight. There's a lot of changes from previous, we'll call it fallout episodes of AEW, where, you know, like in the very beginning of the show, showing the action that is important for tonight's episode, not being so much, you know, WCW in the 90s, where you wait almost a week before you touch on storylines that happen on the pay-per-view. So you try and juice some post-buys from the event. So I thought that was good. And then, you know, that being, hey, essentially everyone tonight was like, what's next for you? And kind of just establishing that we're all kind of reset and on the path here. Now, you know, were all the choices ideal? Probably not. You know, we'll get into it tonight, but would I rather see Kenny Omega and Chris Jericho one-on-one next week in Winnipeg instead of nine guys in the title match? Probably so. Obviously, I think we'll talk about the main event here tonight and what that means for the characters involved. But from a, you know, production standpoint and a focus on the show and what's important and which characters we're driving forward, I thought it was positive, but a little bit of a mixed bag from where these characters are headed. And, Hangman Page comes up in that is probably a net negative on what his character's doing right after that event. So mixed bag on character work, but I think a positive sign long-term for the acknowledgement of the production needed to be better after these shows.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think on the bright side, or, you know, one of the positives of this show is we heard from Bryan Danielson and MJF. And I don't have a problem with them not being in the building just a few days after that grueling of a match. I think having promos from them that were recorded in the, not the heat of the moment, but the immediate aftermath, I think makes for better visuals and makes them more tuned in to the moment. I don't think Bryan Danielson could have cut, you know, and we can talk about, you know, the ramifications of this. And if it's good for AEW to basically saying, yeah, you know, Adam Cole probably coming back at some point, you know, next week or ever, but he's been out. CM Punk, remember him? Yeah, he's gone. And Danielson, he's going home again. Like, there's so many people who aren't around. And then rumors of Kenny Omega, you know, interested in leaving when his contract finally expires. So there's sort of that the danger there, but the reaction, if we just immerse ourselves in this being a real world, is totally understandable. And, you know, his voice cracking, getting emotional and all that, it was great. MJF, you know, bragging about it and, you know, gloating about it in the way that he did and talking about moving forward. I think that was good. You know, I think that they emphasized that. I think they waited a little longer than I would have preferred. Like, you know, when you open up with Jay Lethal and Orange Cassidy for a title that doesn't mean a lot, and Excalibur frames it as, we're getting right to the action. It's like, first of all, what else is new? Second of all, I think it's okay to, after a pay-per-view, four times a year, open up Dynamite with a conversation about that pay-per-view for a minute before you then get to the opening match. I think the placement of how you talk about things matters. And I mean, it's a personal choice. It's subjective, but I think four times a year after their pay-per-views, they should open up. Not, and it was cool that they actually incorporated highlights into the Dynamite opening theme. Some people might have missed that because, you know, instead of the normal background to the music, they aired highlights at the pay-per-view. That I also liked. I would have gone to the announcers on camera, and I would have had them just standing there, like frozen with their eyes bulging out, going, you know, normally we go right to the ring, but I mean, it's a few days later. We're still amazed at what we saw Sunday night. And for those who didn't see the pay-per-view, missed an all-time classic, MJF took it took Bryan Danielson to the limit. They took each other to the limit. Like, talk about that. That was one of the biggest moments in AEW history. And it didn't even, I don't think it got mentioned in passing during the opening match. They talked about other stuff. So positive, the interviews backstage with MJF and Danielson afterwards. The negative, I think they took too long. And I think that, you know, again, it's not a be all end all. There's more important things for AEW, success or failure. But I think just from the artistry of getting the most out of that kind of amazing, epic moment in AEW history, you lead with it, and then you ring the bell for the, you know, sixth most important championship in AEW under any name. So anyway, some positive, some negative in terms of that. There was a lot of follow-up. And as we march through the show here, we got a bunch of emails on this too. We'll talk about the various specifics and if we like what we see so far. You mentioned the main event. Let's shift to that before we move into the next segment. Powerhouse Hobbs winning the TNT title against Wardlow. A pretty lame way to win it. Maybe that's my understatement of the show. First of all, he was counted down, to 10. So he didn't get pinned, didn't submit. Typically titles don't change that way, but this was a anything goes, false count anywhere match. Because Wardlow's car got broken into and he didn't have his gear. So he's like, well, since I'm dressed for a street fight, let's make it a street fight. And not only that, but, you know, they show that Wardlow lands on a thinly covered crash pad. And we see it for what it is. You know, they took heat for it with Jericho. And how many times have they done a spot where it's just like, okay, you know, clearly it was set up for that moment. And, Shivani going, he might have broken his back. It's like, it doesn't look like he broke his back. So that was sort of an eye roll. But also QT Marshall being the reason Powerhouse Hobbs wins. I know you want to protect Wardlow, but how many heels are going to attack babyfaces from behind on the same show, first of all? And second of all, if you're going to have QT Marshall align with Hobbs, don't have the announcer scrambling to try to explain it while it's happening. Like, lay more of a foundation for it. And even Taz goes, we haven't seen him forever, QT Marshall. It's like, yeah, that's actually not a positive. I don't think the audience has really strong feelings about QT Marshall. And if they do have strong feelings, it's that he belongs on AEW Dark and off Dynamite. He's not a major league talent. I'm actually probably more of a fan of QT Marshall's work than the average AEW fan at this point. But I'm just acknowledging what I think fans think of him at this point and the lack of establishing a foundation for that. I don't think it was like this jaw-dropping, oh, my God, moment, QT and Hobbs are aligned. It's sort of like, why is Hobbs aligned with this schmuck and where has he been? Tyler, your thoughts on my talking points coming out of that match?
Yeah, I mean, I would say like deflating was the first word that came to me when I was watching it. And that's also probably being generous, as you were probably generous with your term on the end of this match. And, you know, I thought it was a fun kind of, you know, just insane crash match. I mean, Hobbs taking that bump through the windshield of the car is always a spot. It runs through Temporetta during the pandemic era where he did the same thing. And, you know, you do all that, you have this match to end it with what you said. Yeah, the crash pad spot where, you know, you have Tony Schiavone saying he's going to break his back. And it felt like that is going to be used in some videos where someone, you know, stubs their toe and then Tony Schiavone's voice comes over the over the video. It's like, oh, my God, he broke his back. That's like the level of comedy that moment was. And QT Marshall, I mean, I cannot think of a lesser person to come out and help Hobbs win from the way that AEW has portrayed a heel. You know, maybe Peter Avalon would be slightly worse.
I was just going to interject that as my joke. So we're on the same page.
Yeah, I mean, that's the tier list of where we are in AEW. And it's insane in the moment. We'll see what happens with it. But it hurt Wardlow and this little hotshot run that he had here. And you don't know where he's going with his character. Hurts Hobbs tremendously to look like he needs someone like QT Marshall to win a title, his first title. And it doesn't help QT Marshall seem any more like a legitimate, manager. And it just, it ended a, you know, up and down night. That was, I think, a totally fine episode of Dynamite from an in-ring standpoint and gave me a lot of questions. And, we'll talk about it later, but it reminded me a lot of, you know, just what Hangman did tonight. And you have this epic big win against Jon Moxley, and Moxley does not lose all the time. That still feels special. And then you're just going to, the next, you know, episode of TV have same thing, like Evil Uno, John Silver, Alex Reynolds are these guys that are tiers and tiers below where Hangman's character should be. And that's what's going on with Hobbs here too. He's with this guy who's, you know, tiers and tiers below him. And it brings that top tier talent down to the level of who's around him. And I just don't think it's positive. And that's kind of a trend in AEW that we've seen for a long time. And it's just unfortunately continuing.
And adding to that, the supposed, oh my God moment with Juice Robinson attacking Ricky Starks.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm sorry, but you know, you can put the Bullet Club logo on the screen and it just, that's not enough to make the actual Dynamite audience, what's left of them, excited about Ricky Starks now moving down the card to face Juice Robinson. That's not moving up. That's not. We're putting the wind behind his sail. There's wind behind his sails, and we're gonna, you know, really get behind him now and establish him. I mean, and not everybody can be in the top program at the same time. But that's not a moment that doesn't give a sense of momentum or commitment to Starks. And I think right now, I mean, giving Hobbs a TNT title in a very generic sense, I'm not against. I mean, I think Hobbs is one of their kind of homegrown guys that's been underutilized. He's shown flashes, for sure, more than flashes, of being worthy of investing in because of his in-ring work, his look, his promos. So, you know, I'm fine with him being TNT champion. And I just think a more credible win would have been worth doing. You know, the greatest sports teams and the greatest MMA fighters lose sometimes, and sometimes they lose clean. And, you know, I mean, the last thing you want is like Wardlow going, well, I lost because I was distraught over my car being broken into. But, you know, there's bad directions they could go if he lost clean, but maybe have him lose because of something that, I don't know, Hobbs did. You know, maybe Hobbs beats Wardlow because of that, not because of QT Marshall. So, yeah, frustrating. A frustrating note to end on, as far as that shows go. Yeah, I mean, Eric Crow was texting me just like, I can't use the language in reaction to it, but you know, he's like, Hobbs gets the biggest win of his career instead the focus is on Goofy QT for making it happen, FFS. So, yeah.
And in kayfabe, you know, that a low blow from QT Marshall is more devastating than three spine busters from Powerhouse Hobbs. That doesn't make a ton of sense to me either, but, you know, here we are.
Yeah, but anything goes. So really, I mean, Wardlow looks like the fool because he didn't have his friends come and hit Hobbs with a chair because of the stupid rules that anything goes. And then the heels take advantage of the rules, which the announcer said, hey, anything goes. I think Tess said that. So
hey,
it's like there's not even heat. I guess there's heat on Hobbs because, you know, even though it's anything goes, I mean, obviously he shouldn't be proud of the way he won, but he did take advantage of the rules that Wardlow offered.
Yeah, and then I do want to give praise to Tony Schiavone, who did not praise Powerhouse Hobbs for cheating, as he would typically do as the babyface correspondent. So he's really he's taking notes from you, at least, Wade. So I'm good job, Tony Schiavone, all night tonight.
Well, yeah, and I mean, you know, I can't give a show a thumbs down or be too hard on it when I can see the outside of the arena showing to me.
I know.
Going on for years that you know, should be doing. Now, I will say I think they should show the building when fans are excitedly entering the building, not just, you know, a shot of the outside of it when nobody is around. But that's I don't know if that's – it's not a major problem with it because I'll take the scene, you know, setting the scene and showing this really major league slick-looking brand-new, you know, NBA building with the skyline behind it. I mean, I just think that's a really good touch that just should be a gimme, as it is with every other major sports presentation on cable and in regional cable on the sports channel. So I'm glad they did that. Hope they do it more. But, you know, really capture the energy in those buildings and then when you go to big cities or medium cities. I mean, like I said, I think be proud of every city you go to and make everybody who's from that city feel that you're proud to be there and find things about that market that market is proud of, and it will help return ticket sales if you tout the city and show what they're proud of. And it just, you know, 6 seconds coming in and out of a commercial is all it takes. And to just go, hey, we travel the country, we travel to Canada even, and we're proud of it. And here's something about this city. But booking wise, they gave us a lot to talk about coming out of Rampage, as we expected they would. And like you said, a mixed bag. So let's pause and introduce ourselves in the show. And then we'll come back and get some listener reaction to the program. This is the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show for Wednesday, March 8th, 2023. I'm Wade Keller, the host of the show, the editor and publisher and founder of the Pro Wrestling Torch Weekly Newsletter and the website pwtorch.com, and also the host of various podcasts, including the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast. The flagship edition dropped yesterday. Zach Haydorn, PW Torch assistant editor and the co-star of the PW Torch YouTube channel, joined me, and we talked at length about WWE happenings with the Bloodline and much more in the lead up to WrestleMania, and then also some AEW talk also. So check that out if you haven't yet. Search Wade Keller on your podcast app and subscribe to the Blue Logo Show. That's our regular podcast. If you haven't yet and you're just streaming the show from somewhere, subscribe to this also, the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show. It's our Red Logo Show. We're here live every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday night after Raw, Dynamite, and SmackDown. And the vast majority of you download the final edited version of the show later on that night or the next day. And we thank you for doing that. The other voice you hear is Tyler Sage. He is a PW Torch contributor. He writes Dynamite reports alongside mine at pwtorch.com. Every Wednesday night, so you get two sets of details and perspectives on the show every Wednesday on our website, pwtorch.com. Bookmark it, visit it. And he also is the co-star with Zach Haydorn of the PW Torch YouTube channel going on roughly a year now. You guys have been really pumping out content. Tyler, welcome back to the co-host here. Good to have you.
Hey, good to always be here, too. And don't forget to plug your new YouTube channel, Wade, if you want the opportunity.
I didn't even tell you to do that. Yeah, so my YouTube channel launched like a week or so ago. Just search Wade Keller and subscribe and leave comments and thumbs up and all that stuff that is hopefully genuine, but also helps the algorithm send us to other people when they're flipping through their YouTube shorts or trying to decide what YouTube has decided you want to watch next. We want to be one of those people. So like our video, subscribe, give thumbs up, all that good stuff. That makes a difference. That's a good way to support us. Cool. Well, we have a lot more to talk about. So let's get to it. Our phone number, if you want to give us a call, is 347-215-8558. That's 347-215-8558. When you call, push 1 on your keypad. That will flag you on the switchboard so that we know you want to be on the show. The other way you can participate is via email. The email address is wadekellerpodcast@pwtorch.com. wadekellerpodcast@.com. So I want to actually start with some emails because we got a ton of emails on the show so far. And the first one is from Ken from Nashville. And he said, Wade, are you happy now? You got 8 seconds of a guy walking his bike across outside the arena before the main event. I agree with you on the presentation and felt like this show had some personal shots fired at you from TK with a view from the outside of the arena that had an abandoned facade, no fans waiting to go in, and however many blackouts they did in that JAS Elite segment. I just had to chuckle because these couldn't have been just coincidences, could they? Have a great night. So the lights going on and off has been a joke since I think they did it on their first pay-per-view, and I rolled my eyes. Is come on, it's not 1999 anymore or whenever that was overdone in ECW and other places. But it was, it is something the House of Black does. And if it's something only the House of Black does, I still think it's kind of eye rolling at this point, just because had they not done it till House of Black, it'd be fine. But it's just like, ooh, flipping switches on and off. That's so cool. And I think it's sort of worn out. It's welcome. That said, if anyone's going to do it, House of Black should do it. And, whatever. It's not like a huge deal if they're the only ones doing it. If they do it every week, though, it sort of loses its luster a little bit. Tyler, your thoughts on the lights flashing on and off thing, but more importantly, elaborate a little bit on your thoughts on setting up a three-way trios title match next week, because at first I thought they were going to try to pump some life into Rampage, with the viewership sagging, and have the Elite battle the JAS to earn a shot against House of Black next week on Dynamite. And that would also, I think they're taping Rampage tonight after Dynamite. So that would also give Sacramento fans like a really big time main event. JAS against the Elite would be a big main event for them to follow, Wardlow and Hobbs, which I'm happy they're main eventing and it's a TNT title match. So it adds some prestige, but I don't know that if that's truly the biggest match on your, on the Sacramento event, I don't know if that's going to please people. I know our on-site correspondent, who we're hoping to hear from in a bit here, Ted, was not thrilled with the advertised lineup going into the show. But instead, no, if 6 is good, 9 is better, 3-on-3-on-3. I can't even imagine trying to, summarize that match, referee that match, call that match. It's going to be chaos. Tyler, your thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, on the House of Black, just slightly, you know, Jericho even made mention of it in his promo when he called them to the ring to tell them to turn the lights out and come out there. You know, I think that's a little bit of a, you know, I think Jericho would agree with you on the lights if we were to put him under Truth Serum in podcast form. So I think that's his little way of getting at them, and that tells you kind of where some of the talent feel, and that is overdone. But yeah, I mean, I'm kind of agreeing with you. If one person does it, it's fine, but it's just kind of, you know, it's done too much, obviously. But setting this up, yeah, I mean, it's like I said at the very top of the show here, I really thought, I was like, oh yeah, they're in Winnipeg next week. Maybe, you know, Kenny's here, Jericho's here, we're going to set up a little bit of a, you know, Winnipeg Derby, and those guys are going to main event. That feels like a really good main event, and you could have Jericho cheat to win, get a big win back, and reestablish him and JAS as a dominant force, because they're one of the coolest factions in the company. And instead, yeah, just having them come out. You have House of Black, which I'm not sure where their standing is. I would guess, I would say they're a babyface if you had to ask me. So it'd be another babyface making a stipulation by their choice that puts them at disadvantage, which is trending in WWE territory from, you know, about a year ago, where every babyface was the most unintelligent, you know, person on the face of the earth from the stipulations they were agreeing to and whatnot, which is not a good way to build a babyface. So, yeah, I mean, and just besides the match itself, like, if you're there live, it's a spectacle, but, I mean, it is going to be a mess. And, you know, good for Jericho. He doesn't have to work a ton in that match. I think that's kind of the plan there. But I don't know. It doesn't help the Elite or JAS to lose a match like that, or House of Black, and do the same thing they've done with Wardlow. So it feels like a no-win situation from a booking standpoint as well, to have all of those teams involved and burn through two potential matchups. Because, you know, you could have the Elite lose again, and then you could have JAS set up for the pay-per-view, which we're, what, 7 weeks away from? And instead we're kind of burning through matches, kind of like we did with the Acclaimed and the Guns and all that stuff. So it's kind of bad booking on that perspective as well.
Yeah. You say House of Black are the baby faces. How sure are we of that? And how are we supposed to feel about the Bucks in Kenny? I mean, I ask that question sincerely, because nobody aligned with Don Callis, who is, you know, Don Callis is forever a sleazebag. Like, there's just no, he doesn't play any other character but that. And, you know, and so, but he's out there yelling at Chris Jericho about, I could train for 2 weeks or 2 months and be the second greatest Winnipeg wrestler. Like, so he's not a baby face, but obviously, the way Jericho and Chase Stoddy are acting, and their own actions and their own words in this segment and later, they're not baby faces. And, I mean, House of Black are just, you know, what did they say? They're creepy or something like that. But they're not bind in any particular way. So I just, again, I just don't know how we're supposed to feel about any of them. And I think that hurts. And it would be one thing if it was a philosophical decision that they could explain and back up. And I don't think that they would or could. I think it's just, well, who cares? Just the bell rings and they do a bunch of great spots. That's what we're here for. And why can't you have that? And also good character definition. It doesn't mean every good guy has to be pure. But fans should be invested in somebody winning and somebody losing, or you're going to lose fans who actually care about that and aren't just into chanting, this is awesome, and seeing, you know, dives and super kicks and high spots nonstop. And it just seems to limit themselves. And I mean, that's a perpetual issue with AEW, but I really think that segment sort of, not to overstate it, but sort of epitomizes that point. I just don't think you want people exploding with enthusiasm and excitement over the prospects of somebody getting what they have coming their way and then earning what they deserve. And, you know, we see that with, you know, certain things going on in WWE right now with the Bloodline, and it shows how magical it can be when you really understand somebody is you've captured lightning in a bottle, so to speak, and then people are really behind someone, and you play that, you play into that. And I just don't know if the Bucks and Kenny and Don Callis could explain their characters. I don't know if House of Black can. I don't know who can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think a systemic issue within AEW, as you brought up there. And if you look at who is, let's say, the best, which characters are the most defined are the guys at the top of the card as well, right? Your MJFs, your Danielsons, your Adam Coles when he comes back, your Hangman Page, your Ricky Starks even. And then even, you know, Christian Cage, he knows his character way more than anyone you just mentioned. And I feel like you can set up a bigger match with someone like that than any of the nine people that are coming up in this match. So it just is, it feels like the division that the Bucks and Kenny are were given by Tony Khan to book to kind of appease them. And it feels very much like an indie or PWG sort of setup that, you know, this was set up on one indie event. It's going to be at another PWG event later. And it's awesome. And you don't need a story because it's going to be an awesome match. And it is a little disappointing to be 3+ years in, 4 years at this point, and have a lot of the same issues. And it's, I mean, for me personally, it's hurt a little bit of expectation on some of these AEW shows, knowing that these things happen over and over again. And I'm kind of resigned to the fact that some of these divisions are just going to be booked in certain ways and certain characters are going to not develop and not tell the stories that people tell me are being told that I'm not seeing on screen.
Who are these people? Yeah. And also I think there was some excitement coming out of Revolution for a lot of reasons, but one of them was Kenny Omega is going to go back into the singles division. Mm-hmm. Now, maybe it's just delayed by 1 week. Fair enough. You want to have a big match on Dynamite in Winnipeg, and you're like, well, we're not going to do Jericho Omega one-on-one. We'll do, you know, trails match, whatever. I mean, I can see their rationalization for it. But you got Don Callis tweeting out a picture of him and Kenny Omega. They look like they're dressed to be national TV stars, not that they rolled out of bed and picked up whatever was on the bedside and dressed in it like Omega sometimes has looked, a little haggard and a little too casual. And they look like stars. They look like they took some time to present themselves in a certain way. And then, you know, Callis said, our focus is back or something along those lines, which, of course, drew a ton of comments to me, which is, oh, so they're admitting they've been unfocused. Well, are they going to return some of their paychecks? Are they going to apologize to the fans? What does that even mean? What does that imply? Well, the implication was Kenny's back and he's going after the gold. Like, that's what people took from it. He'll face whatever. He might be a logical opponent for MJF, not as the baby face with Don Callis by his side. So that it continues to be an issue. But now we're just right back to this ill-defined trios team with Don Callis speaking on their behalf. It could be done better. I don't know what's going to happen coming out of it, other than there's going to be a long match with a bunch of, you know, really good, cool athleticism that people are in the building are going to go nuts for. Mm-hmm. But I'm curious if there is obviously I'll give them a chance to show that there's a larger purpose for this. Maybe it's to draw rating and get everyone in the ring, but then there's going to be some very definitive kind of character developing moment that happens in or after the match. And they kind of move on from it. It might be a way to get the Bucks and Kenny's sort of like not obligatory, but like they should get a rematch. They're the former champions. So now they're getting it. But they don't necessarily have to take the fall because there's going to be another team in the ring with, you know, some people who maybe are, you know, more likely to be seen as being able to absorb a loss without it affecting their future. And I don't want that to be the reason, but, you know, I'm not ruling it out, Tyler.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the way to go. I mean, I'm certainly as a fan cheering for not the Elite to win because I want the Bucks in the tag division. I want Kenny doing what you pitched there, and I think was a lot of people's mindset of maybe potential matches with MJF, and it feels like both, you know, the singles and tag divisions are better for them in that spot. But that's kind of what I was talking about earlier with my, you know, my reservations on thinking that at this point, because it feels like it's not a priority for that group to buoy those divisions in the way that I think a lot of us would like them to. So as a fan, that's certainly a disappointing factor going into all this.
Yeah. All right, another email. This is John from Tennessee. He said, do you guys think it's a missed opportunity not to do Kenny Omega versus Chris Jericho one-on-one in their hometown next week instead of this three-way six-man tag? Missed opportunity, I'm not sure I'd – well, I mean, yes. I mean, by definition it is because that's a cool – you know, two Winnipeg natives going one-on-one. They're legends. Yes, in that sense, it's a missed opportunity. Storyline-wise, I don't know that you should give away – you know, I don't want to call it a dream match, but, you know, two top-tier singles wrestlers against each other with no program. They're both heels, I think. I don't know. against each other with no backstory just because that's the city you're in. Like, I'm not sure I want to endorse that. That said, I guess my answer is kind of yes. I think doing a one-on-one match between those two on a show that's been, you know, losing viewers, you know, let's be honest. I think that has more appeal than a 3-on-3-on-3 mega spot fest match without any kind of clear cut storyline or babyface heel dynamic going on either. I just think, yeah, I think some people would tune in for Omega Jericho, and I think they'd tune in bigger numbers than they are for the three-way trios match. Yeah, I guess my answer to John is I would prefer that. And I think it does fall in the category of a lost opportunity.
Yeah. And I would agree. I mean, that's what I was thinking watching it. And, you know, I don't think Kenny and Chris Jericho are on the same level they were a year ago, right? I mean, that's not a work rate from either of them. I think they're both about the same in the ring, but it's just what they've done with their characters and, you know, things cooling off for those groups for definitely different reasons for both of them. But it's also the meta of it, right? Like, what is Kenny going to be doing? Where's Kenny going to be working in 6 months or however, whenever that contract's up? And
yeah.
If you want to make this match happen to pop a rating, if you're not sure where that's going, you know, I don't know why you'd hold it if you didn't know what was going on. So lots of factors going into it. I don't think it's a make or break to do it or not do it. Yeah, I mean, not building to it would kind of be an AEW tradition at this point, but, you know, I think it would be good if it happened, but at least there's some semblance of it here in this match. And, maybe you can build to it in the future if it's something desired. So, you know, yeah. It's a little bit of a cop-out, but it's better than nothing, I would say.
Do you think they should do babyface Kenny Omega against heel MJF at some point in the next, you know, sometime this year? Like, is that a real good match that they should start steering themselves towards, but in a way that, you know, makes storyline sense with, of course, ideally the fans behind Kenny Omega, which means his security blanket, Don Callis, can't be standing next to him on promos because you can't be a babyface with Don Callis next to you.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that is, I mean, my gut instinct is yes, obviously that makes sense on paper. It's something that you would have booked from day one of AEW if you thought MJF was going to be what he is right now. It seems like a natural progression on where those characters would go. But, you know, you have to, you know, be Tony Khan. You have to see what the, you know, the buy-in from Kenny Omega is at any given time. And, you know, if you do that, like maybe I do that as a TV, you know, it's built over 3 weeks and it's going to be a headliner for a branded Dynamite instead of, you know, 6 weeks and doing that as a pay-per-view match, because I just don't know if I have the confidence in Kenny to be the foil, the positive foil for MJF in that capacity and be believable the way Danielson was when we knew Danielson had absolutely no chance and sold us, you know, to slightly believe it was possible. I just don't think Kenny's up for that at this point with his, you know, choices he's made. So that would be a negative for me. And so I'd probably build it for TV, honestly, at this point.
Yeah. All right. John from Tennessee also says, I'm really disappointed that Hangman Page versus John Moxley isn't over yet. You'd think after a death match that ended with a guy being hung by a chain, that would be the end of it. But I guess not. I really feel like Moxley needs to be off TV for a few weeks if they're going to do this character change. None of this is working for me. Thanks for all the great content, everyone. Go VIP. Thank you, John. Credit to John Moxley for being able to wrestle a few days later and being willing to and not saying, no, you know, I mean, I don't want to do this. I need to rest up. You know, yes, on a personal / professional level, that's a great employee, so to speak. But he shouldn't be on TV wrestling. Like, I mean, that match should have been so grueling. Second of all, he lost type of match. And it's just, what, now I'm going to just wrestle a tag match and move on to the next feud with Dark Order? Like, and that's a whole other issue is, you know, that we're in, you know, getting into 2023 here. And, you know, the Dark Order is still, like, they're worthy of feuding with Moxley and Claudio. I know Hangman's affiliated with them. So it on a number of levels, it's just like, I don't think Moxley should have wrestled yet. He should be selling the effects of the match, too. I don't think he should be feuding with Dark Order ever. He's too big of a star. And three, yes, I know Hangman and Dark Order are aligned, but the Hangman-Moxley feud should be over. So I'm with John. I would have rather had, you know, Moxley and Claudio. But, I mean, you need to do some other things to make this make sense, but have Moxley and Claudio turn heel and have the Bucks be clearly defined as baby faces and do those tag matches. I think people would much rather see that than the direction that they're going. Or, you know, if they're not, or go at, you know, just cut a promo, declare, you know, have him limp to the ring with Claudio and say, we're going after the Acclaimed. We're, you know, sick of these guys, whatever. I mean, there's other matches people would rather see than Dark Order. There's choices, beyond those two teams even, but those two sort of jump out to me as, oh, that feels like a fresh reset following a pay-per-view. And I get what John's saying. This doesn't feel like a fresh reset. It sort of feels like, what was that death match all about if we're going to get more between them because Evil Uno of all people got beat up?
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree more. I think there's really everything with this. I have problem with. I mean, I think even making Moxley a heel is an uphill battle that is not worth it. I think we saw that when he almost went heel before he, went away for his health reasons and came back and, you know, was the ace of the company, was the guy that held things together through everything over the second half of last year. And I don't think that, I just don't think the crowd is going to easily turn on John Moxley consistently. And it just doesn't seem worth it to me on that front. But yeah, I mean,
well, but Tyler, he didn't turn. He's not a heel. They're just more aggressive. We don't do face. I don't even know. I mean, I honestly don't know if that's their argument. Like, it's not about heel and face. They're just more aggressive and ruthless. And it's up to the fans to decide. Like, maybe that's their argument. And we're not trying to turn him heel. You can cheer him if you want. I don't think that's a good approach, but it might be their answer to the idea of it's an uphill battle with a lot of headwind to get fans to boo him.
Yeah, I mean, maybe. But, I think we both know. I think the audience knows where we stand on that being the case. But yeah, and then the stuff with Dark Order and, Hangman being with them, that was, I did the pre-show today on the preview show today on YouTube, and I said, I'm worried about Hangman being involved after this match and just being, again, associated with Dark Order, and I thought this was a great opportunity for him to move on. He got a huge win against Moxley, move on, be that top guy, take on an MJF type at Double or Nothing, get a huge main event, probably lose, but, be reestablished as that guy, that top three babyface in perpetuity that you can be. And just hanging out with Dark Order doing stuff like this doesn't help that either. And, I don't know, what is this building to? A trios match between them? It seems like the women are going to get the blood and guts match this year. But if not, this seems to be the blood and guts match. It's just, the whole thing is, we've seen it so much. And it feels like a reduction of the characters that we saw. And it makes these pay-per-views that, as you said at the top of the show, feel, are great in-ring shows. And makes it feel like they're in different universes from the TV, because we keep kind of going back to the same feuds and stories over and over again, and the characters don't develop a ton, and they have awesome pay-per-views. So, and I do like AEW. I know I sound more negative than usual tonight, but it's, I had a lot of hope coming out of that pay-per-view that we'd get a good reset here and people would be in good spots. And I don't think this was a good first step off of that from a lot of key character development.
If the show tonight ends in time for us to bring our on-site correspondent on, which I hope works out, hope Ted can call us in time after the Rampage tapings. I'm curious what Sacramento thought of the show. I'm curious what they got after Dynamite went off the air, because he had expressed to me he wasn't thrilled with the announced lineup. Mm-hmm. And, I'm just curious why people are buying tickets to WWE events. You can just go, oh, yeah, it's this, 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 and this. And with AEW, it was like part of AEW, it was because it was this movement. It was this anti-Vince McMahon thing. It was this tribute to indie shows. It was a wrestling promotion by wrestlers for wrestlers, which lasted all of a month or so before the wrestlers were booted from the booking scheme. Not entirely, but, certainly the execution of the vision changed pretty abruptly over that first holiday break. I'm curious how fans reacted, because when you're, the crowd was good. I mean, they were into it, So I'm curious for his take on that. Anyway, let's go to Zach in Texas next. He goes, you people promos, in quotes, you people promos are nearly universally reviled because they typically conflict with what the audience has seen and heard and are an attempt to get cheap heat. Tonight, Ruby Soho bucked that trend and actually cut a logical You People promo. The specific instances she cited were legit and reasonable reasons for resentment. She even made sense of what happened Sunday by saying that the fans' reaction to Jamie winning is what pushed her over the edge. Now the outsiders, so to speak, have two things they've lacked, a strong mouthpiece and a clear mission statement. It finally feels like this feud has slid into a new gear. Well, first of all, I think they had a strong mission statement going into this. And I also think they have a strong mouthpiece in Soraya, and I think Tony Storm's underrated's word, but I don't think talking was their problem. And not that Soho didn't cut a good promo. I didn't think it was off the charts great, but I thought it was good in terms of her delivery. Did it stand up to the praise Zach is giving it? Because I had mostly positive thoughts on her promo, but I'm not quite sure it checks all the boxes that Zach is saying, including, and this is what I was trying to remember timeline-wise, if Tony Storm a babyface when the interim status was removed from her title reign retroactively?
Yeah, she was a babyface her whole run. I think it was
And the only reason I doubted that is just because Ruby said that was disrespecting her, but She turned heel after AEW respected her by rescinding the interim title from her. So it did, like, but again, Ruby's being a heel, so she doesn't have to pass the truth test. She can be spinning history a little bit. But that jumped out to me as like, okay, that's stretching it a little bit in terms of a reason to have resentment. I really did like, though, that she said she didn't decide to turn until she turned, because that is the only – that helps the situation make more sense, because the criticism of the match on Sunday is why did they wait for Hayter to win to work together to defeat her. And so I think that was addressed, and I actually think that's the most important thing in that promo. And the best – it was the most important thing in the promo, and it was the best aspect of the promo. Your thoughts on what Zach said and what I said there, Tyler?
Yeah, I like this a lot tonight. I think it was a highlight of the show for a couple things. The small thing is I love that the promo was before the match. It just, like, so much bucked the AEW trend of having, like, a match to set up a promo for some reason. And the fact that, you know, she had a scheduled match to talk before, I thought was just, like, honestly a really nice touch and made the show feel fresh in a different way. Maybe that's me who, and like you, write everything down so everything feels formulaic in a certain way. But yeah, that was good, and that was my big complaint of that match on Sunday, was that it felt so dumb for the two heels to not team up and do that. But obviously, this made a lot of sense, and it didn't feel like a forced retcon of the situation. It felt like it was actually the story, you know, weeks ago was put in place to do this, as opposed to a lot of times in AEW where they fit the story, you know. Cut my hair for a certain reason, you know, being the most latest version of that. And yeah, so I thought it was good. And then, you know, my only gripe tonight would be, I think that unless Sky Blue is going to be part of that AEW original group, the fifth person of that group, then I don't think she needs to go that long with Ruby. I think Ruby should have, you know, beat her in 2 minutes flat and looked dominant. But, you know, and I think the promo itself was good as well. I think if you grade it on a curve, you know, I don't think any of us would say Ruby is the greatest, you know, promo in the business. And I think she excelled at what she was to do and, you know, fought her way through the chants. I mean, she got a shut the F up chant, which I think MJF and Christian Cage might be the only two that I've gotten that I can think of. So she really earned that heel heat tonight and pushed through it in a way that was believable. So, yeah, I thought it was really good, and I was pleasantly surprised. And she, you know, walking out, she's the focal point. Obviously, she had the match, but I was like, oh, wow, is Ruby the leader of this group? It felt very much like, I can't remember the name, but her and Liv Morgan and Sarah Logan. I'm sure someone is screaming right now listening to this. Their group in WWE, but, you know, that's peak Ruby Soho in WWE. So, you know, I'm here for it. I'm interested. I think she did a good job tonight, and her versus Britt on the mic, I'm looking forward to that in the future. So I think it's a win across the board.
All right. I like the threesome as an anchor heel faction in the women's division. I think they're different from each other in valuable ways, but they also seem like there's going to be some good chemistry between them as a heel trio. And as a heel trio, they can work tag matches and, you know, singles matches at the same time if they have separate feuds at different times. So yeah, overall, I'm not against the Ruby Soho turn. I some people have been like, does anyone want to see Ruby Soho as a heel? You know, and have been against the move. I don't think she was going anywhere as a babyface. And I think personality wise, I don't think as a babyface with a mic in hand, she owned the ring enough. And there's so much, I think she has a lot going for her. And so what you want to do is you want to find a way for wrestlers to be in a situation that hides their weaknesses and accentuates their strengths. And I think interacting with playing off of Saraya and Toni Storm is actually like really good use of her. I think that she'll shine and thrive in the situation more than what sort of felt like she was floundering for a while since her arrival.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So let's, okay, we have a note. I want to make sure it's not a spoiler from the Rampage tapings. Yeah, I don't think it's a spoiler. But, you know, fast forward 10 seconds. It was just an announcement about the March 31st ROH pay-per-view. Mark Briscoe came out and cut a promo, and he announced that an ROH tag team ladder match for the ROH tag team titles will take place March 31st. A Reach for the Sky ladder match, and the Lucha Brothers will be the first entrants. So a little breaking news from our correspondent, Ted, on site at the event. Okay, so let's go to Azan, who says, hello, Wade. Do you think Ricky Starks in the stuff with Juice Robinson could lead to something bigger for New Japan and the Forbidden Door pay-per-view? Yeah, well, I made fun of it a little bit earlier, the Ricky Starks. But if Juice Robinson is like the beginning of something and Ricky sort of, you know, and not to disrespect Juice, but he just hasn't been framed as like a big deal and a big star in AEW, even with a Bullet Club logo on the screen, it doesn't undo that. But if it's like, well, Ricky plows through him, but then it leads to others showing up or like a feud with Jay White or something like that. I mean, sure, that then it might make some sense as time goes on. Tyler, what do you think?
Yeah, I'm trying to brush up on my I'm off of my New Japan stuff, but I know David Finley joined Bullet Club recently, so that feels about the same level as Juice Robinson. As I'm going through my Rolodex of Gaijin guys in New Japan, so yeah, I mean, I think the leadership is open there with Jay White being gone, but you know, if Jay White's going to be in AEW, it would make sense, I guess, to do this. But you know, then what do you? That seems like a, I mean, it'd be a great setup because you have Jay White coming in and you have Ricky Starks on a winning streak. So, you know, you can really define one of those guys by beating the other, but it feels like you would save that and not kill Starks' run here by Jay White coming in and beating him. But, yeah, I don't know. I mean, it didn't feel like that to me. I mean, Forbidden Door is, what, the end of June, right?
Yeah.
It's like June 24th. So,
yeah.
So, I don't know. It just doesn't feel like there's a ton of, and no pun intended, but juice to this at the moment. So, yeah, I don't know. I didn't think much of it, honestly, and it felt like a Rampage win for Ricky Starks, and that was about it, is how I felt. It's kind of like Aussie Open being part of those tag team battle royals and doing absolutely nothing. It just felt very strange, and like you're diluting that surprise entrant from another company, and that's kind of in Tony Khan's style, obviously, with the Will Ospreay, him coming the first time and Jay White coming the first time didn't feel very special. So it feels like we're on that trajectory. So sorry to be negative on that question there as well.
He also says, was the Wardlow car break in a storyline idea in any way or just something they went with, but it legit happened? I don't even know. I mean, it seems like it could have been legit. Did that come across as was it confirmed as a legit thing that I missed on social media or anything?
Yeah, I think it was – I was thinking that too, but I think it was all but confirmed it was legit because if it was worked, wouldn't Wardlow be the one – or Wardlow, wouldn't Hobbs be the one that broke into the car and took it, and that would be like part of the story to get in Wardlow's head? Or QT Marshall was the one to do it?
Well, they might – I was thinking they might still reveal that.
Yeah, but I mean –
so, yeah, and I just don't know either way. It seems like it could be either, and I just haven't had a chance to check on it because I didn't hear about it till Dynamite, so –
it just doesn't seem like AEW would hold something like that. You know, I think they would pull it right there at that main event with QT Marshall. He would like had a velvet bag and had pulled it out and laughed like he was the mastermind behind the whole break-in. I just don't think AEW would hold a story for 2 weeks like that. If it is, it tells me even more it was real. But and who knows? Maybe there's some, you know, long-form podcast in the future where Wardlow is like, yeah, that was my fault, and I got the, you know, Tony's like, you're losing the title tonight because you lost the title physically or something. You know, I think that's a possibility too. I'm not really. How often does that actually happen? I mean, that's putting you on the spot, Wade, but the only time I can think of is Jericho losing the belt when he first won it at the beginning of the company's history. But beyond that, like, have major wrestlers lost titles before? It just seems like a big no-no for a
wrestler. Yeah. Well, oh, okay. Anyway, let me get to this last thing you brought up. Do you think there will be a Blood and Guts match this year? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think there will be for sure. Like I said, I think it's going to be the women. I think it's going to be the Outsiders versus the AEW Originals. It's, you know, the fourth Blood and Guts match if they have it. So that would make sense of like, oh, it's the first all-women's Blood and Guts match. And, you know, that seems very much in AEW's wheelhouse to do it there. The story is there. The only other faction war that would make sense is JAS versus somebody. And we certainly don't want to see JAS in Blackpool Combat Club. And, you know, the Elite versus JAS, you know, you need to add people or Dark Order versus, you know, BCC. None of that's very intriguing. So I think the women's story is the best option there. And you can give them a spotlight and tell that story and then have several matches come out of it and use that as a vessel. So I think that's the way they're going to go.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that makes sense. All right. Let's see. Briar from Council. Whoops. Breyer from Council Grove, Kansas, says, I've had a few questions. I have a few questions about this week's show. One, what are your thoughts on AEW opening up with the All-Atlantic title match for the past couple of weeks? Do you think it helps elevate the belt by constantly defending it? And do you feel it starts becoming predictable after a while since Orange Cassidy is usually retaining the title? Well, first, I'd say a champion retaining the title doesn't make it predictable. It's just that's a possible outcome of a match. And, you know, at some point he'll lose, but he's got to, you know, champions win and then they lose. So I don't think there's anything predictable good just because Cassidy's winning. I don't think it makes the belt more prestigious that it's opening Dynamite, unless the contrasting option is just that it's never defended or it's only defended on Dark or Rampage. Well, yeah, then it seems more prestigious because it's on Dynamite, their A show. But this does open things up. One, to answer his question specifically, is it good to open with Orange Cassidy? Orange Cassidy defending the All-Atlantic title. And is it something they should do as often as they are? So that's part one. And then part two we can get into, which is the renaming of the title and how they went about it. But first, specifically to Breyer's comments, Tyler, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think you kind of said it here, Wade, but I think any title is elevated by the person that has it, the run they're having, the way they are, you know, their work rate, the way they're presenting themselves, et cetera. And I think Orange Cassidy, as much as anyone that's had that title in the short history of it, has done a lot to elevate it, having good matches, and, you know, fitting his character to, you know, be a perfect vessel for this doesn't really matter, but, you know, you want him to win it and retain it, and therefore you care about the belt because you care about Orange Cassidy. I think tonight was a big confirmer of that for me personally, like Cassidy getting in that figure four and really selling it and you know, rolling out like he's actually in a fight. I thought was some really good work by him and Jay Lethal as well tonight. I think they told a good story. And, so that's where I went with that. And then, the renaming, you know, I had to confirm it was not the Intercontinental title, but I had to definitely check to make sure I wrote the right thing, the international title. So, you know, in 3 months, I think that's going to be a big problem is people saying Intercontinental. I think someone's definitely going to say Intercontinental title on television on AEW. And that's a big unforced error that is going to happen at some point. So look out for that. But yeah, it's better than All Atlantic. I mean, that's really dumb. And it's an acknowledgement that this is a dumb title to begin with and unnecessary. So, you know, instead of just getting rid of it, which is what I thought it was going to get absorbed into something else with the announcement, like Shazam was going to take it, you know, the character and run off of it or something. But yeah, I mean, it's a better name, but it's confusing with the Intercontinental title, which I think is a net negative. But, and then, you know, the whole, you know, if we're going to make fun of the Pitch Black match, we got to make fun of Shazam, whatever BS that was. But, you know, that's just capitalism. And, you know, I think we'd all do the same thing if we had a company and got a big check to hawk Shazam on TV. So
I need to brush up on the WCW International World Heavyweight Championship that WCW had Ric Flair beat Barry Windham for back at Beach Blast 93. I remember Rick Rude being the longest reigning champion. I associate that title with him. But the title just was unified with the WCW title like less than a year later.
Got the whole history in front of me if you want it.
Well, no, we don't. I mean, I probably covered it enough. People can look it up. Yeah. But then there was the NWA International Heavyweight title that was introduced in the 50s and made it all the way to the late 80s. That was the sort of an NWA title that was, I think, largely fought in Japan. And I need to brush up even more so on that history. So the term international title has some history. Tony Khan might be aware of it. I'm not saying it's a glorious or well-known history, but I will take the term international over All Atlantic because, well, for all kinds of reasons. That said, I wrote this in my report at pwtorch.com, why not make it a TV title? Why not have it be a television? AEW doesn't have a TV title. It, to me, international and world are rather interchangeable. So what makes the world title more prestigious than the international title? And where does this rank compared to TNT? TNT is not, it's an international network to a degree, but if we just go based on the name of the title, isn't international now kind of leapfrogging TNT in prestige versus just the Atlantic? I mean, it's all sort of silly, but setting aside the name of it, what is its purpose? Like, what is its existence? If it's a TV title, you can define it. For instance, you could say the TV title will be defended every week by the champion, either on Dynamite, Rampage, or Dark. a TV champion is going to be the most fighting champion in AEW, but the stipulation is nobody can fight for the TV title who has ever had a shot at the world title or the world and TNT title. You can even do that. Make it just clearly defined as a developmental title, a title that is a way to make your mark that you're on the rise, but you are nowhere near a world title match yet. And that's where you can establish yourself and defend a title and have a streak going. Like, again, it doesn't have to be specifically that, but that's a spitball of a way to say it's different. It has a different group of contenders. It has a different regulation in terms of how it's defended. And it stands out as having a purpose then. I genuinely don't think Tony Khan or anybody could answer what purpose it exists and how it's different than the TNT or the main world title.
Yeah. I mean, I couldn't agree more. I would, you know, be the third option of not having it in general. I think you probably would agree with that as well, but
yeah.
define what it is, have it be, you know, even if it's defended weekly on TV, it could be on Dark and try and move some eyeballs over to Dark. And then maybe, you know, two out of the three, 4 weeks of the month, it's on Dynamite or Rampage, and then it's on Dark the other two, and you have people that are not even signed. They're outside the company. You have a high-profile indie person that goes for it, and you might have a segment of the population that goes and sees Orange Cassidy take on a speedball Mike Bailey or something like that. I think that would be a much better use. Would make it more prestigious with the hardcore fan base than it is currently. So, but yeah, we'll see what it is. I think eventually the path for this belt is to get absorbed by the TNT title, and then it's the TNT international title. Yeah. So we can keep the lineage there, but whoever does that will be like Cody making the Intercontinental title white, you know, 12 years ago on SmackDown or whatever that happened when he got a huge babyface cheer for that. So,
yeah. Yeah. All right. Number two from Breyer. Another question is on Air Fox. Fox has been on the show, it seems like, more and more these days, and I feel like he's a fairly decent fallback guy. What are your opinions on him, and do you ever see him challenging for a secondary title, such as the TNT and former All-Atlantic title? What do you think of Air Fox and the way that he's been, you know, introduced as a mentor of Top Flight and, you know, an indie guy who paid his dues, and now he's getting some national cable TV exposure and nice paydays?
Yeah, I'm a fan of his work. I was a fan of him on the indie scene a lot, and I think how he's been used is good. He is a guy who is a high flyer, and he, you know, I think that can almost be a detriment to him that he's, you know, an elite high flyer in every match he's been on in a company full of elite high flyers. So that kind of almost puts you in a weird zone where you're not going to get pushed as much because people don't want to look bad compared to you. But yeah, I think defining his character a bit would be good, you know, sort of like Dante Martin was able to do while Darius was injured for that long period of time. If you just, you know, can define him week over week a little bit, you know, he could totally, if an Ethan Page is champ at TNT or international champion, then I could see an Air Fox going up against them. And I think that's a perfect good use for him. He's a much elevated version. Matt Sydal, how they were using him, you know, years ago at this point. And I think he's an elevated version of that and keeps the high work rate on the show available and someone that you want to cheer for, and maybe we'll get a surprise win occasionally, but it's ultimately going to lose more often than not the way he's portrayed currently.
I'd like to know a little bit more about him in a wrestling character sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just some, I mean, again, there's just too many wrestlers who seem like they are out there to do spots and be good, you know, just be athletes doing athletic stuff in the ring. And I guess if he's going to have, as Breyer says, if he's going to have that much time, TV time, I kind of want to get to know him a little bit better. You know, I want to know how I should feel about him a little bit more.
Yeah. Or at least, you know, hear his voice. I don't know if we've actually heard him talk on television.
Yeah. Yeah. And maybe that's not his strength, but there's other ways that you can, you know, make us care a little bit about him. And it doesn't mean a 8 minute mid-ring promo or even a 1 minute backstage promo. It can be an inset promo. It can be it can be a brief backstage promo. It can be the announcers talking a little bit more, you know, about him. I don't know. Breyer brought him up, and I was thinking when I was watching him, you know, for as much TV time as he's getting, we just don't really know a lot about him, and I'm just not a fan of expecting to be invested in somebody winning or losing when I know almost nothing about them. I think, you know, and so if he get, he's going to get this much TV time, let's get to know him a little bit better. You know, what is he, what are his goals? What does he stand for? What's his personality? What are his interests? Why would anyone, you know, identify with him? All right. Breyer's third question is on the Jericho Appreciation Society. I'm not really excited about this tag team challenging for the Trios title next week, as I feel like they've run their course. In your mind, do you think they've run their course? And if not, what more can they do to get them hot again? Thanks again for all your work, and I enjoy your podcast, all your podcasts. Thank you, Breyer. I'm not really excited with the team challenging for the Trios title next week. So it's teams challenging, and I'm not sure if he means, you know, I'm not sure what he means by they've run their course. So I, Tyler, do you have a sense of what he's actually asking there?
Yeah, I mean, I think the team is you know, the Garcia, Sammy, and Jericho as the unit from JAS, which is the strongest unit that you can make from that group. But, yeah, I think he's just talking about JAS in general and saying it a couple different ways of how he is not thrilled with them at the moment, and I would agree. I thought on Sunday, you know, with JAS banned at ringside, I thought there would be someone that would was not originally part of JAS that was going to join JAS after the match. So they were going to come out and screw Starks over and kind of be an injection into that group because, yeah, it's just – it's not working. I mean, you have three guys who are all comedy at this point, some better than others, and then you have the other core of the actual wrestlers, and they've been defined down for months and months and months. And, yeah, I don't know. You know, it depends who – you think it's salvageable. You know, I think if you threw Garcia into ROH and you have Jericho kind of get some wins against some lesser guys and be his own, you know, reestablish himself in some way, shape, or form, it's better than what this version of JAS is. But, you know, if you want to continue down this path and they're just kind of where they are, I don't think it's detrimental to the show. I just think it's, you know, they're the fifth most exciting group in the company or something like that. And that's not really where Chris Jericho should be, in my opinion, for how much time he's gotten, how much clout he's got with the AEW audience at this point.
Yeah. Yep. All right. Brett, appreciate the questions. Email address, as always, wadekellerpodcast@pwtorch.com. You can send questions in throughout the week on anything. We'll find a time and place to answer most of them. Please do that. As thoughts or questions come to mind throughout the week, we'll use them on the flagship sometimes and on our post shows. If we have time, we got a couple emails earlier in the week just in generically about frustration with AEW that we might get to. We'll see how the pacing goes here, but otherwise I might read them on a VIP Wade Keller hotline later this week too. Okay, up next, JB says, "Hey team, it's JB from Detroit." He's got several points here. Because of Jay Lethal's recent history of dishonest tactics with his stable behind him, it doesn't make sense to me why the best friends wouldn't have been prepared to intervene more quickly for the post-match assault. There's that. I want to introduce also for you, Tyler, in response to that. Can you explain why the referees and Pat Buck ran out to stop Jarrett and Satnam Singh and Sanjay Dutt from accompanying Jay Lethal onto the stage, which the best friends had just done for Orange Cassidy, you know, seconds earlier? Was there some logical explanation for them rushing out to the ring to intervene like that?
Maybe it was selective reasoning by them of knowing that a certain group has cheated more often than not, or, you know, in kayfabe sense, maybe there was some talk backstage of Jeff Jarrett was going to interfere in the match and some official heard that. So they wanted to make sure that was stopped. But yeah, nothing was said on commentary or on the stage or was out of the ordinary from a visual standpoint. It's one of those things that you get with AEW where you have to kind of connect, you know, the A point and C point and create the B point in your mind to kind of flush out the story. But yeah, not ideal, but it's one of the things that happens on a weekly basis. So not a huge issue for me personally on that front.
Yeah. All right. Number two, I'm not sure that Juice Robinson is who I want a red hot Ricky Starks to feud with next, unless it's just a quick bridge leading to Jay White. Hey, great minds think alike. I also thought that Ricky should have gotten a bit more time in his promo to bask in the Jericho rubber match victory glory. That's a mouthful. Let me try that. I'm going to try this again. I also thought that Ricky Stark should have gotten a bit more time in his promo to bask in the Jericho rubber match victory glory. Okay, I'm happier now. I thought Ricky Starks did deserve or should have delivered a better promo. I didn't think that was one of his better efforts, and I don't like Ricky being cutting a promo that's just a setup to be interrupted. That's for people who aren't good at talking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm trying to think of the meat of his promo right now without looking at the report. And he said he had a good week, and that, you know, he was ready to, people were asking him to move on and what he's going to move up to. And then he got interrupted. Right. Am I missing anything off the top of your head? So,
no,
I mean, the point there is like, it was not very memorable, which is not, you know, doesn't attest to a good promo, but yeah, it's, not a good use, I would say, for him. You know, him and Hangman were the two guys who were promoted as we're going to speak. You know, MJF and Danielson were not promoted as such, and I would have switched those two, and I would have promoted that MJF and Danielson were going to talk because those were good promos. And, you know, the Page stuff didn't matter because he said he was done, and then he ran out there and fought Moxley, and then same thing here. So, yeah, not a good use. And you know, I would say I would probably push back a little bit personally with Ricky Starks being, you know, white hot at this point. I think he's cooled off in the last month just from the booking decisions there. You know, I was trying to think today who's going to go up against Starks next, and there didn't feel like a perfect person for him was set up and kind of on that same zone from a heel perspective, where, you know, I think like most companies, whenever you have a face or a heel champion, your 2, 3, 4 babyface or heel is underdeveloped because they're not as important for that main area, and that sort of 4th, 5th babyface suffers because they can't go up and beat someone up the card. So that's an issue, but that happens with all wrestling companies. And I would agree, I guess, is the moral of the story.
Yeah. Is Ricky Starks at still near the top of your list? Greg Parks has a column on it in this week's Pro Wrestling Torch newsletter about the wrestlers who won at Revolution and what could be next for them and how to capitalize on their momentum. What are the pros and cons of really getting behind Ricky Starks, and what does that entail in your mind specifically at this point?
Yeah, I mean, I would say the three contenders I have to beat MJF at this point in order would be Adam Cole, and then probably Ricky Starks, and then Hangman Page would be my third from a power ranking standpoint. So, you know, pay-per-view matches, I guess, quality opponents. So, you know, with Starks, obviously you got to talk about the meta of it all, you know, him being Cody's guest at the Royal Rumble and things like that. You have to consider of, you know, do you want a similar MJF situation that you dealt with in the past? Make sure that person is locked down to a contract and happy, all that sort of stuff. But then the other thing is like, you know, if you look at all the past champions, I think from a competitive rate, like work rate standpoint and the work style, Ricky Starks is most comparable to a Chris Jericho. And, you know, I don't think he's unathletic. I just think he works that more of that WWE style. And to go from, you know, MJF, I guess Punk is Punk too. I guess I've kind of eliminated him from my mind, but he's more like a CM Punk, right? Which works obviously, but to go from a majority of your champions being the Kenny Omegas, the Hangmans, the Moxleys, the, you know, MJFs, it is a big transition. And you have to do a lot of things more story focused than, hey, these two are going to have an awesome match and that we can build it mainly from there. And I think that could be really good for AEW to focus on storylines for your champions mainly. And then the work rate is kind of secondary. But I would be, you know, I'd be worried as a fan if that were the decision made, just because I haven't seen that come through on a regular basis, especially in the main event scene.
All right, and up next, he says, why did we have to make the real-life break-in of Wardlow's car part of the main event story? It was rather irrelevant, in my opinion. Also, I'm not a fan of the completely random, arbitrary stipulations being added to all these big matches lately. Yeah, the second part is more of an issue for me than the first. I'm not a great fan of let's up the ante by making it no rules. Like, I mean, there's kind of a reason rules exist, because it helps figure out who's best at the skill set that should be rewarded with championships. And so I get, you know, no rules, no DQ, last man standing when there's a storyline, personal rivalry reason for it. I'm just not sure that's the majority of the time part of the reason they do this. I think they do it because it's like, oh, it's a little something extra for the fans because rules are dumb and no rules is awesome. And especially when you look back and you think, oh, they did that because they didn't want anyone to do the job. Like, they played as, quote, smart fans, internet fans, savvy fans, meta fans. They play to them, but then they book promotional tactics that those fans see through, that are transparent. Oh, they want to switch the title, but they didn't want Wardlow to get pinned or submit. So we're going to have, you know, cheating and a countdown finish be the reason. As far as incorporating Wardlow not, you know, having ring gear because his car was broken into, I mean, if that's the only ring gear he had, I mean, I guess you kind of, you know, I'm somewhat sympathetic to deciding to do a street fight, come as you are, because he doesn't have appropriate ring gear. And it would be, I guess, kind of weird to wrestle just a standard match in, like, you know, sweatpants or something. I don't know. What do you think, Todd?
Yeah, I mean, on that last point, I think you'd book it in a way where maybe he could come out and do a promo at the beginning of the show, quote unquote, and then Hobbs attacks him and he's like, all right, let's do this right now. And he could do the same thing in the street clothes and make it reasonable. But yeah, I mean, I think the story didn't, you know, I think it's fine to tell that. And it was also strange on that front that there was a TNT title sitting on the announce table. I don't know if you saw that while watching. I mean, I know they've made 37 versions of that belt. So I think Tony Khan probably keeps two of them on him at all times because there's so many floating around. But that was strange from the storyline perspective and using that break-in as an option. But yeah, I think the main thing there is what you brought up there is the late added stipulation. And that to me is just, hey, there's some booking decisions that change the day of more often than not. So to do this to protect someone like a Wardlow, like this man that had not been the plan Sunday coming out of the pay-per-view. But then, you know, it to me screams of something that was decided that day to then protect Wardlow in a loss and decide to go with Hobbs in the end is what that tells me from a, you know, booking perspective.
He says, also, in hindsight, we should have made the connection of Ruby Soho's recent fashion choice of green attire and hair to her inevitable heel turn as it connects to the green spray paint that Saray and Tony Storm have been using. I will say that's more coincidence than intent, especially because Ruby is claiming, and I believe her in terms of her character's journey, that she didn't decide it for sure until the reaction to Jamie Hayter's win. And I don't think that green spray paint and green attire is like – green's not that unusual of a color. So I don't know. Do you think there might be something more to that, Tyler?
I would say probably not. I mean, if you want to spin it the other way, too, you could say Saraya was trying to subliminally court Ruby Soho by choosing green as her color. So, you know, I think you can get yourself spinning in circles when you think of it that way. I think the only wrestler that's ever done that, as far as I know, is Natalya. She would change her hair from blonde to brunette when she was going from face to heel to signal that to the audience, but I think that's her doing, you know, kind of some old school tactics because of, you know, her family. So I don't strike that as Ruby. I just think black and green is a good combo, and she found a good hair dye that she liked, I think, more likely than the former.
He says, at first I thought Soho blaming the fans for her turn was lazy storytelling until I heard the actual promo and it made more sense, aside from the cheap heat calling the fans neckbeards. Most of Soho's shortcomings in AEW have been at the hands of AEW originals, so there is continuity there. She did get the fans to pretty strongly turn on her, so the reaction was far from apathy. We talked about this earlier, but I think that's I think a lot of us went through what JB went through, which is, oh no, not another one of these.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was like, oh yeah, okay. and you know. Was this where Tony where Tony said good point and then, oh, but I'm not taking sides? That was a funny moment in the show. Yeah. Tony he wants to be Switzerland. I'm not taking sides, but, you know, good point, or at least worth considering or something like that, which was kind of funny.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this stuff is like the good use of a meta narrative is when you spin real things that happened that people saw on screen and, you know, is discussed on podcasts like this. But you take it and you give it your perspective as a character and say why that hurt you and why you would then not trust the people that did that to you, right? I mean, there's lots of things of why that happened. And Tony Storm did go through the same thing of like coming in, everyone being excited. The booking was not ideal. When she's champion, she's not on TV very often, and therefore she cools off. And that being the reason, you know, it all works because we saw it in front of us. And if you are a longtime viewer, you appreciate that being acknowledged and talked about. And if you just watched the pay-per-view and watched this, you have some context of why someone would change and you get a quick synopsis so you're not left out. So I just think more of this should be happening when you're going to do meta storytelling if you're going to do it.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. Then he says, also, I do like what the Moxley feud has done for Hangman in the sense that it has given him the toughness, confidence, and edge that he had been lacking for some time now. It was something we were all asking for, and Mox is a perfect guy to bring it out of him. So what do you think about that? Is even if we think, oh, continuing the feud, still being aligned with Dark Order in a feud against Mox and Claudio and Wheeler Yuta isn't a great follow-up to something that should have concluded a feud, is there this kind of broader positive, which is Hangman does have this edge now and has shown a toughness in beating him at that?
Yeah, I think 100%. I think, you know, that's why he's in that top three I gave you of people that I think could be positioned in a pay-per-view match against MJF from a babyface perspective. And winning against Moxley shows the faith that Tony Khan has in him as a worker and his character and everything like that. So there's the meta part of it, but also the character part of it, obviously. Like, Moxley does not lose very often, so getting a clean win against him is makes you a top-tier guy. And also, it earned Hangman a leather jacket. So, you know, he's definitely, you know, changed his character from that, and I think anyone that beats John Mox in the future should earn a leather jacket like you earn a green jacket when you win the Masters. I think that'd be a nice little touch if we're going to talk about little accessory nuances there. But yeah, I think this being not ideal for his character in the intermediate, I still think the win against Moxley in the future will be a touch point of his career, winning the title. And then the next big touch point is him defeating John Moxley in that type of match, going to that level, proving he can do it and he will do it. But that's not going to be him all the time. I think his important note for his character was in the grand scheme of the next decade or what have you.
By the way, our on-site correspondent just said he's going to call us in a couple minutes here. They're in the middle of the last match. So that's good because I'm eager to talk to him. Okay, JD's got two more points. I think it was smart of Tony Khan to set up two of Winnipeg's favorite wrestlers in Omega and Jericho for a trios titles match. Adding JAS was smart as well, so they can take the fall. It's smart. It also might be a bit of a cop-out. Does AEW want to be in the business of concocting less preferred matches to main event a TV show because you don't want to be a brave booker and understand that there's going to be big stars who win and lose sometimes? Not just win, but also lose sometimes. So that's the downside. But yeah, I mean, if you deconstruct it, you can say it's clever and savvy.
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, the lesser of many evils, I would say. If you're not going to have the singles match, this is the next best thing. You have a title match, you have all the stars in the ring, you can get there. But, you know, it's not ideal, right? It's not the perfect scenario. And I think, you know, the way that Jericho and Kenny are positioned right now within the company as singles guys, a lot could happen. It's 50-50. I think it'd be you know, a good match, it'd be an interesting story, and it kind of shows, like, if you're trying to protect everybody, like, you're going to that level, like, where are Kenny Omega and Chris Jericho if you had to rank singles performers in AEW right now, you know, if there were the rankings back in the day, I mean, they'd be out of the top 10, so when you're protecting that many people from that many kind of matches, I think you're getting into a dangerous territory, personally.
And finally, he says, I'm glad AEW is rebranding the All Atlantic title as the international title. Hopefully this will give it some direction and uniqueness in only being defended on international soil. That being said, I thought TK did a pretty poor job of explaining the rebrand. Okay, is that actually it? Maybe I blew it. Did he say we only are defending it outside the United States now? Or did he just say it's the only title that's been that changed hands outside of the United States, so I'm calling it the international title because we're going to Canada next week, which is different?
Yeah, the second is what he said. I'm almost certain. That it changed hands in Toronto, I don't know where they were in Canada and when they were, but yeah, it changed hands there. I think that's when Cassidy won it, right? So yeah, that's why I said, because the AEW world title and every other title only changed hands in the States. So that's why that was his reasoning, I would say. So
it's not a title that only be defended outside of the United States.
No, unfortunately, that is incorrect. That would be great if it was home length, but then there'd be like one or two shows a year. But
yeah. Although really the world title should be, you know, defended outside the United States, and you don't need an international title for that.
Yeah. Correct.
Okay. Just want to be clear. Okay. Up next, Jay from Columbia, South Carolina. Just a couple thoughts on the fallout from Revolution on Dynamite. One, it seems like they always open with an Orange Cassidy match, which always starts the show on a non-serious foot. Will changing the name make it less of a joke? Spoiler alert, almost certainly not. I feel like we probably covered this. And sadly, I think calling it the international title, while an improvement in name, might actually amplify the title being a joke, because yes, the name was bad, but changing the name seems to ignore the larger issue, which is that there's too many titles that aren't differentiated from each other.
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge issue. I think everyone that listens to me at any point knows I'm for less titles all the way around, three of titles included in that capacity as well. I honestly, like I said earlier, I think someone's going to call it the Intercontinental title at some point. It's going to be a huge egg on their face moment. And that just to have it even be close to that, I think it's just bad from a marketing standpoint, let alone, it feels like you're the number two company when your secondary title is close to name to the major company secondary title. So I would just avoid that as much as possible on the rebrand. But, you know, it is what it is.
All right, number two, the Danielson promo was so great at highlighting the agony of defeat and even explaining why he tapped out. It's a shame that it also marks the end of this run. MJF was great as always, and I'm not sure why people are concerned about his in-ring skills, as he's almost always put on good to great matches. He's also in great shape and looks every bit the part of a main event wrestler. Well, I agree with that. I mean, first of all, yeah, the promo is great. The agony of defeat is great. And the MJF's in-ring skills, I mean, he doesn't have, you know, a decade, give or take, of indie great indie matches or New Japan Tokyo Dome main events or PWG, you know, five-star matches. I mean, so what? His body of work in AEW is clear. He's like world-class prodigy in-ring talent. Is that overstating it, Tyler? I mean, he's not the most dazzling athletic high spot artist, but every test he's had in the ring, I think he's really come through. And I don't really think even the perception is that he's not a worthwhile wrestler. He's just, you know, a different type than some of the others, but I don't know. I mean, I think he's comparable to some other top respected wrestlers. It's just his body work isn't as long.
Yeah. I mean, this has been a weird narrative to me this week that I've seen a lot. And yeah, I mean, it just tells me that people that even bring it up just maybe have a shorter attention span and just like have not remembered every match that MJF's had in AEW has been, you know, really, really good. I mean, obviously different context for different matches, and the one on Sunday was a, you know, world title match, and that has more weight on it than, you know, a match with Sammy Guevara. But like, there's a match that he had with Sammy Guevara at Daly's Place that I think is Sammy Guevara's best match of his career, at least within AEW. So, you know, when you're that kind of guy, that's like, you know, the way Danielson and the way Moxley have made people just within the AEW ecosystem. I think MJF is right there with them on, you know, a Takeshita or a Kenny match, you know, might be absolutely insane and high flying and really be great. But those guys tell stories and work different types of styles of wrestling. They more match their strengths of their opponents to, you know, accentuate what they're doing. And he's a great worker. So it's an interesting discourse I thought this week. I don't know what the other question was, though. Sorry.
He always put on. He's also in great shape and looks every bit the part of a main event wrestler. Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean,
sure.
I don't think any new fan tuning in to pro wrestling after 8 years away or never watched before is going to look at MJF and be like, well, who's this guy? He doesn't look like Roman Reigns or John Cena or Hangman Page or John Moxley or Chris Jericho or Kenny Omega. I mean, it's like he looks like he belongs, and credit to him for being, I think, very conscientious of his look and the way he carries himself. You know, he wanted to accelerate into this position of being perceived at a very, very top level, and he has.
Mm-hmm.
Number three. So after a decisive and bloody victory over Mox, Hangman is moving backwards to hang out with the Dark Order again. I figured he might be up next for MJF, but apparently not. So who's next for MJF? There's time to set up a challenger, but I'm not sure who that might be at this point. Oh, surely a battle royal or tournament will answer that question. Oh, come on, Jay. Yeah, do you have a sense right now of the grab bag of options where they're going to steer things?
Yeah, I would say if it doesn't happen, like they don't set something up next week or at the very latest the week after next, then MJF's probably not going to wrestle until the Double or Nothing pay-per-view. So that gives some more time for, you know, I think the trajectory of AEW at this point, when you just look, you know, like when you go from Full Gear to Revolution, you almost have to put on a pay-per-view level Dynamite, which they did at the LA show. And then you can kind of reset yourself. So, cause there's such a large gap, but now you can do like a 2 or 3 week interlude stories with people and then kind of refocus people for the pay-per-view. So I think, you know, Adam Cole is coming back. Is it the end of the month now? Cause that's when that show premieres and that's when his promo was, you know, he said he would be wrestling the same night as that All Access show premieres. So he's wrestling, yeah. I guess at a worst case scenario. I mean, I guess not for his health, but for us as fans wanting to see him wrestling at the end of the month. So someone like that could, you could fire him up and get that spot. But I think Starks and Paige could both get through what they're doing right now. Starks especially. And so I think all three of those guys would be available to do it. But yeah, so I guess hopefully that rambling answered the question, but this feels just like more like interludes for people and kind of getting prepared to set up pay-per-view matches after the next couple of weeks.
Yeah. Yep. All right. And I think his final, one more point here. Oh no, two more points. Can FTR save the tag division? We haven't talked about FTR yet. I hope so. Hopefully the Elite tosses the Trios title match next week, loses the Trios title match next week, putting the Bucks back in the tag title hunt. Yeah, well, I don't think the Elite are going to regain the tag titles. Do you, Tyler? Is there much of a chance that they belts just go right back to Omega and the Bucks?
I don't think so. I mean, I think it's more likely than JS getting those belts. But yeah, it feels like House of Black. I doubt they would, you know, flip two belts like that. The TNT title happening tonight, I think all but you know, is going to give House of Black those titles. They're gonna get those again. So. But yeah, on that, and then on FTR, did you want to answer that before I did?
Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, they're certainly feels like of all the divisions to get reset last night or tonight, you know, the world title scene is kind of neutral because nothing really happened there. But the women's division and the tag division after tonight feel the most reset and excited. You know, as a fan, I'm excited for both of those where they're going. You know, obviously the FTR are a big reason for that. And you can see the trajectory of, you know, I'm trying to be mean here, but like the adults are back in the room with them. And like them as champions, you see like them versus Lucha Bros, them versus the Young Bucks, them versus, you know, maybe a Moxley and Claudio sort of tag team. That feels more like what this tag division should be. So, you know, that I have hope for that. But I was, you know, I like FTR a lot. I think obviously with those ROH matches with the Briscoes that they talked about tonight and lots of other matches, they've earned the right to be the praise that they get. But, are you ever surprised, like at a reaction like that tonight for a group like that? Cause honestly, like I'm always kind of surprised that in 2023, a group like FTR, the way they wrestle, and their overall style can be literally the most over thing on the show tonight. I know they just came back, but it's always kind of interesting to me.
Yeah, yeah. We got a wrestler saying babyface, too, in a promo. You don't hear that too much on national shows. Yeah, they were mega over. And, you know, people have talked about it. I assume Tony Khan has heard. The AEW tag division was a point of pride among AEW fans. And now it's like, you know, the acclaimed and the guns. So I think people want to see FTR beat the guns. I think they want to see FTR defend the titles in, you know, some classic matches. I don't want them to just have FTR be, you know, the best bout machine type tag team where it's just, you know, we're going to have one great match after another. That would not be awful. I'll stipulate to that. But I think people would like there to be also, you know, storylines and feuds and, you know, FTR's faces against clear cut heels, or if it's a babyface team that's deserving, you know, frame it that way as, you know, a battle between two people who have respect for each other and make that a reason to tune in a, like, you can't just decide something's going to be a ratings draw, but create a strategy for it, the end goal to be that it's a ratings draw. And, you know, make FTR feel really special in whatever they're doing as champs, if they beat the guns and start defending the titles, whether it's in a short amount of time with rapid fire defenses or spread out, not quite spread out like MJF's title defenses, but if they spread them out and really make them count, either way that can work, but turn that into a point of pride. Now that a lot, some of that depends on the status of FTR and AEW and where Tony Khan and FTR stand. And at some point it's going to be awkward if FTR and the Bucks can't work together. Cause you know, however they feel about each other, you'd hope they can be professional enough to give the fans the match they want and be professionals about it. And if the tension is still there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep. All right. Finally, Jay says, why did Wardlow win the title on Saturday just to lose in this convoluted way? Why couldn't they have just left the title on Joe and let Hobbs get a clean victory over an established veteran like Samoa Joe, or at least a clean victory over Wardlow? Good for Hobbs anyway, I guess. Yeah, this isn't the most prestigious way to begin a title reign. QT Marshall wins it for you after a lame, you know, some lame series of things. But I think they wanted Hobbs to be a heel. And if Hobbs beats Joe, this legend, you know, it might cheer and respect Hobbs for doing so. And so I'm just kind of getting in Tony Khan's head, you know, booking-wise, why the decision was made. I think in this case, they wanted to do a more traditional, you know, heel cheats to beat the baby face and take something from him. So I guess that would be my explanation. You know, having Wardlow win the title and then lose it quickly to Hobbs puts Wardlow quickly in the position of being the baby face chasing down the challenger. So, you know, in that sense, that's, you know, often where you want the baby face to be. And it's tough for Wardlow to be in chase mode given his size and just his overall, you know, look and style, but Hobbs matches him in that way. So, you know, having Wardlow chase Hobbs, I'm fine with. I'm curious, setting aside or, you know, taking into account or setting aside either way how they went about it tonight. I'm hoping we see both Wardlow and Hobbs grow as characters and get TV time and, you know, when they're feuding with each other and then whatever happens afterwards, because Hobbs, I think, has something going for him. Wardlow has something going for him. I think Wardlow is in a better position now, being a little bit more, you know, I like the haircut. I like the demeanor. I like him opening up about his life a little bit more and, you know, not doing, you know, Wardlow's world and trying to be something that just seemed like a bad fit for AEW. Your thoughts on Hobbs and Wardlow kind of in general, incorrect. Anything else I said there too?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have much explanation for the booking tonight. It feels like if you're going to do this, you could have done a triple threat match at the pay-per-view. And you could even, if you really want a QT part of this, you could even have that happen there. You know, I don't know, tonight. I mean, not that the legacy of this title is the most important thing, but, I mean, there's, of all the titles, you know, it's a top four title in the company's history. It was one of the, you know, four original titles, if you will, the men and women's championship, the tag team titles, and this. So, you know, to hotshot it once is not terrible, but to make a habit of it would not be good. So, I don't know. I'd like to be excited to see what they do with Wardlow coming out of this, and Hobbs for that matter. But I don't think that AEW has shown a way to book, especially Wardlow and Hobbs to a lesser extent, as either they're monsters who destroy people in a second, or they, you know, lose big matches is kind of their defining characteristic. So to get out of that rut for both of them, I think would be good. And, you know, Wardlow's had more competitive athletic matches as champion against, you know, in game championship from Joe and taking on people like Darby, et cetera. So, yeah, I guess I'm not as hopeful. I don't know if you are either. I think you're just pitching the positive side of this now that we're here. But, yeah, I think getting Wardlow and Hobbs both more defined as characters and working different styles of matches, being presented in different ways, the character-wise and in the ring, is important. And, you know, Wardlow chasing here doesn't interest me as a fan because we just saw this, but that might be the story. And then, like, if you finally get to a Wardlow-Hobbs rematch in a couple weeks, like, you know, I don't know. If it goes back to Wardlow, it feels like we're on an infinite circle of these guys fighting forever for this thing. And I don't know if that's the greatest place for the title, personally. But we'll see what happens.
Okay. I want to see if our on-site correspondent is ready for us. I see it's called up. Let me just check in case it's not quite ready leaving the arena. Ted, are you ready for us to bring on yet?
Yes, absolutely. I'm here.
Oh, great. Okay, good. welcome. Great talking to you.
Thanks. Great talking to you. 24-year subscriber,
yeah.
First time dialing in.
That's just crazy. I know. I could search your emails and it would be a march through decade, you know, 2.5 decades of wrestling interaction with you. So it's great getting you on as an on-site correspondent tonight. Well, I'll ask you a generic question first. What was it like being at a live AEW show? Had you driven to any others before?
So the only other live show I went to was pre-Dynamite. I went to the Fight for the Fallen show at Daly's Place. So this is my second time at a live AEW show.
Cool. So what's your main takeaway? I know you had mentioned, and I mentioned earlier, you were not thrilled with the announced lineup ahead of time. When all was said and done, including the Rampage taping and anything else off air, what's your impression of the product right now?
It was definitely a fun show to be at. I was glad to be there. I would go back again. But, you know, it definitely doesn't feel as hot as it was last year or even 2 years ago. I would say. I was also disappointed coming off the pay-per-view that, you know, no MGF in the arena also.
How full was the arena tonight?
So the entire upper deck was tarped off, and so with the stage and the hard cam, I would say they could have sold about 10,000 seats, and they probably had about 7,000 there.
Who got the biggest star reaction, Dynamite, Rampage, otherwise, the whole night?
Believe it or not, it was FTR. FTR was just over huge. They were going to cheer them as much as they could. It was just amazing. And then the Acclaimed got a big reaction during Rampage. Hangman Adam Page got a big reaction. And until Powerhouse turned at the end of that match, he was big over as well.
Interesting. Tyler, jump in with a question for Tex.
Yeah, so let's talk about Hobbs and that Dynamite main event that we saw with QT Marshall coming in and helping Hobbs win there. What was the reaction to that for you personally and in the live crowd? What was, you know, mixed reaction, all negative, good heat, bad heat? How'd that go?
Well, the match started out really quiet in the arena because the match started, you know, on the TV monitor. And so it didn't get loud until they actually got into the arena, and it was really loud, and people were rooting for Hobbs. I wasn't personally, but people were definitely rooting for Hobbs. And then QT came out, and we saw him for about 15 or 20 seconds before he interacted, and it was just dead silent, and it really wasn't a great reaction.
Oh,
so after the match, QT and Hobbs came to the ring and cut a promo. Did that air, or was that only for us?
That was only for you. So, yeah, please let us know what that promo was about.
Yeah.
So Hobbs came in, and he cut a phenomenal heel promo in the ring after the match. You know, he was just, like, hitting on Sacramento, you know, Sacramento's crap.
Oh, wow.
And I'm going to leave this ring and actually go to a real city. And Sacramento people have an inferiority complex over the Bay Area already. So that was just like hitting her was very well received.
Interesting. Another thing tonight that I was curious, the crowd reaction there was the post Moxley Claudio tag match when they were kind of beating up Inner Circle member or Dark Order members and then beating up Hangman Page. You said Hangman Page got a good reaction. So what was the reaction to John Moxley specifically, you know, kind of doing some heelish aggressive tactics there? Was it boos, or was it kind of like, oh, I don't know how to react to this for the live crowd?
Well, that's a great question, because during the match, it was all confusion because no one could tell who's the face and who are the heels, you know. It's like, first off, how do you root for the Dark Order? That's just a problem to begin with. although everyone really liked John Silver. But, you know, it was clear by the end that the Black Blue Comic Club was going heel until they started booing them. But it was just confusion during the match because no one knew who to root for.
Interesting. And then this will be my last, and I'll throw back to Wade here. But Tony Khan, I assume he came out. Did he say anything of note, or is it, you know, just normal stuff? And then crowd reaction, you know, good, was it positive or less than you expected?
So Tony Khan came out about 2 minutes before Dynamite came on, and the crowd was very, very positive, you know, treating him like a celebrity superstar. And after the last Rampage match, I just left. So he might have come out again, but I don't know.
Yeah. So was there anything that happened before Dynamite went on the air other than the Tony Khan moment?
There were 8 dark matches taped. And, you know, they're all pretty much.
I'm sorry, did
watches.
Anything of significance happen? I'm kidding.
Yes.
I'm here all week.
Nothing too exciting. You know, when Aubrey came out the first time during one of the dark matches, they announced that her family was there, and so she got this huge cheer. But nothing really of significance.
What for Dark Order spoiler-free purists? Fast forward 30 seconds. But was there anything of note in the dark tapings in terms of a wrestler who stood out as either especially good or bad, or crowd reactions or maybe match quality that people should seek out next week when it's released?
So the one match I definitely would steer people towards was the Jack Cartwright, Brian Cage match. I thought that, you know, really came across well. And both of them are relatively local, so the crowd was definitely enthusiastic about it. From my own, Brian Cage is about 50 miles north of here.
Oh, okay. Very good. So once Dynamite started, we had Orange Cassidy, Jay Lethal. They had a pretty long match to kick things off. Did they hold the fan interest? Being the first big-time match, you know, I know there's a bunch of dark matches, but, you know, when the Pyroblast and everybody knows they're live on TV, did they, you know, benefit from that, or did they lose the crowd at all? Did anything surprise you about the crowd reaction during that match?
So they definitely held the crowd. The crowd was, you know, doing dueling chants of, you know, Jay Lethal, Lethal sucks, Jay Lethal, Lethal sucks. And I was surprised there was a lot more pro and con Lethal chants than Cassidy chants. There were a couple Cassidy chants, but it was much more focused around Lethal.
Oh, interesting. Did it seem like Jeff Jarrett was over as a heel? Like, because there's a criticism of Jeff, which is, well, he's good at what he's doing. He's a real pro. And, you know, AEW can use that. You know, an experienced guy who's been everywhere and knows all the tricks of the trade and all that. But is he sending the right message to AEW fans and potential viewers as, you know, a sort of surprising fixture of television these days? Were you able to gauge from the Sacramento crowd if there was any sort of like, oh, what's this guy doing out here? Or, oh, it's Jeff Jarrett, cool. And there, he's almost kind of become nostalgic and accepted, if not embraced, by AEW fans.
Polarizing figure. There are people in the crowd, me included, who were like, go away, and then the person sitting next to me was like, oh, no, I love his podcast, And so he was into the nostalgia. So it's very polarizing. I people who care are definitely on one side or the other.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah. I can. It's interesting how the podcast can kind of make a difference too. The women's the Ruby Soho promo, the women's segment. We were noting earlier a good heel crowd response. The crowd chanting "Shut the F up" at her. Did she hold the audience? What did you think of her ring presence in owning a large major arena like that? And in what some ways it's certainly her biggest AEW moment, having to stand there in the middle of the ring and explain her heel turn. How did that work out in front of the live crowd?
Well, as I'm looking at my notes, number one on top heel reaction was Ruby Soho. She got the loudest straight heel reaction of anyone. The one thing I will say is they have got to change her music. Her music does not fit a heel persona. Like, ooh, how can, like,
that's
that
true.
Music...
But it's a real song, though. Yeah.
I know.
No,
and
I
it's
know.
A great
it's
song,
tough to
and
get rid of something you get
her,
the license
but
for.
Not
yeah.
as a heel.
Yep. Exactly. Yeah. And like Sami Zayn, if he ever turns babyface again and then they actually go back to it, people can explode with cheers. Ruby's back. How about the reaction to Kenny and the Bucks coming out? Like a star reaction followed by what?
So I was picking out people cheering Kenny over the Bucks, which was surprising. I thought people would be cheering the group of them, but people were cheering Kenny specifically over the Bucks, which I thought was interesting.
Interesting. But they were both – if you didn't know anything about AEW and you just said, oh, I'm going to go watch a pro wrestling show, see what this is about, would you come away going, oh, the Bucks and Kenny are a big babyface act based on how the crowd reacted?
Not from tonight. No, not from tonight.
Okay. So Kenny got cheered more than the Bucks, but they weren't like mega over in terms of a crowd reaction. Is that a fair assessment?
Correct. Yeah. Yes.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay. Okay. When they aired the vignettes with Bryan Danielson and MJF, I can imagine two reactions. One, oh, on a big screen, this is compelling. It was a big classic match. I want to hear what they have to say. There also might have been a sense of, oh, they're not going to be here tonight. We're not going to get to see them. You expressed some concern to me about the advertised lineup going in and the star power. So talk specifically about the reaction to the vignettes and then also your personal opinion on how they came through in terms of overall star power.
So I thought the vignettes were, you know, great other than being live at the arena and wishing I was seeing them live and in person. But I thought the vignettes came across well, and people were not looking at their phone during the vignettes. People were staring at the screen, and there is only one screen right behind the entrance stage where they were showing it. People were very focused on the screen.
Interesting. Cool. So is there anything – oh, the Tony Khan announcement. I was thinking of the other big screen thing. Did that hold the fans' attention? How did they react?
So that they may not have shown. What was the Tony Khan announcement?
He announced that the All-Atlantic title, since it is the only AEW title that's changed hands outside of the United States so far, has been renamed the AEW International title, and it will be defended next week in Winnipeg.
And that did not get announced for the live crowd.
Oh, interesting. So the video didn't air at all, or you just couldn't hear it?
No, the video did not air at all.
Okay, interesting. Well, now we're breaking news to you. Yep. Is there anything else from Dynamite itself before we get into some stuff from Rampage, which people might want to skip past if they want to watch Friday and not be spoiled? Tyler, you can plug yours if you want. anything else from Dynamite that stood out or just kind of the overall live arena experience?
So the only thing that in my notes I'm flipping through that we didn't talk about is – during the JAS Top Flight match, the fans loved singing mm-hmm. Judas. Everyone was into that, as they are every arena. But what I found was the crowd was strangely dead for the actual match.
I mean, I guess that is weird because it was a lot of high spots and action and didn't last a super long time. So I guess that's not great news.
Yeah, I would agree.
Any theory why? Yeah.
I don't have any great theory why other than, you know, maybe they're just over the JAS because they did talk about the fact that this was their 1 year anniversary.
Yeah. Yep. So anything else from Dynamite?
Nope. I got things from Rampage, but I'll wait.
Yeah, so, Tyler, is there anything else you want to ask about anything other than the Rampage taping at this point?
I don't think so. I think we covered it pretty good.
Okay, yeah, so, Ted, go ahead with some details on what happened at Rampage. I'm curious to see what they did or hear what they did.
So I was expecting it to go faster from Dynamite to Rampage. It was almost 20 minutes of them changing all of the logos and turnbuckles to get to that. So that I would say, hurt their momentum. At the start, I would say only about 10% of the crowd left, which they're aided being on the West Coast because it was still, you know, only 7:15 at that point. And
that's a good point. Yeah.
So Jim Ross got a huge applause when he got introduced, and then they did Judith a second time for Jericho's introduction before it started. The other thing I noticed, which was surprising, is in the arena, they did the matches in one order, but that is not the order they're going to show them on TV. I always assumed they taped them in the order that they showed them on TV, but they absolutely did not. Because, for example, the last match that they did for the arena was Action Andretti versus Sammy Guevara, but it was clear that was going to be the one they're going to show first on TV.
How was that clear? I'm curious about that.
So they did the introductions. Then there was a slight pause. Then on the TV, they did the Rampage opening. And then they did Pyro on the stage while Sammy was just kind of hanging out on top of the ropes in a corner. And then they started. And then the Nyla Rose Riho match, when Justin Roberts announced it, he said it was one fall or TV time remaining, which was strange given it was the second of the matches that they were showing.
For sure. For sure. Yeah, that's awkward. There's going to be some kid in the audience who's asking his parents, like, what did that mean?
Right. So there was a squash match for the Acclaimed. The Acclaimed were over huge. Everyone was really into the Acclaimed. The Acclaimed did a good rap on the way in. And and obviously the Acclaimed won their squash match. Nyla Rose and Riho had a good long match for about 12 minutes. It's just hard for Riho to be believable against such a big wrestler as Nyla Rose. You know, just the weight difference is probably more than 2-1. I hope the TV announcers, harken back to the fact that that was the original women's title match, so it was a rematch of that. So then Mark Briscoe came out to cut a promo, and so, spoiler alert, he announced that he's relinquishing the Ring of Honor tag team titles, and they're going to be defended on a ladder match called a Reach for the Sky ladder match at the March 31st Ring of Honor pay-per-view. And he also announced the first entrant, which will be the Lucha Brothers.
Yes, very important ROH news there, and it seems appropriate he would retire those belts, all things considered. Anything else, Ted, from Rampage?
So,
have you covered all those?
So Preston Vance, Takeshita. Takeshita was over big with the crowd, Takeshita won in about 12 minutes, no surprise there. And Action Andretti and Sammy Guevara probably had the most high spots of a match, which I guess you expect for a Sammy Guevara match. And Sammy Guevara won after some interference with the JAS.
Very good. Anything else at all from Rampage?
Nope.
Cool. Anything else, Tyler, you want to ask Ted, or any lingering questions?
So you said only 10% of the crowd left at the first match. What would you say it was like for the last match that you saw live? I would say, if that makes
sense.
What percentage of the crowd had left?
So I would say 10% had left at the beginning of Rampage, and I would say a third had left by the end of Rampage.
Okay. Will you go, Ted? Will you go back? Do you think it was a good value for the price and the trouble of going to a live arena and everything that entails? Is this like, I'm for sure going back if they come back in 4, 6, 8, 9 months? Or did this leave you more or less enthusiastic about the AEW product and the live experience?
I definitely, look, I wish it was a better card, but I enjoyed myself, and I would definitely go back. And, you know, I would have gone to the Bay Area for matches there, but I knew the Sacramento one was coming, so, you know, I'd even drive the 2 hours into San Francisco if I needed to.
Very good. Well, Ted, thank you so much for taking time to talk to us about your experience today.
Oh, you're very welcome. Have a great night, you guys.
Absolutely. Great to finally talk with you. Thanks for your support all these years, too.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you for all the great VIP content. And everyone out there, go VIP.
I like what you're saying. Thanks, Ted. PWTorch.com/goVIP. Find out what all the fuss is about. Find out why people have been VIP members, customers, subscribers for decades following our work. Very good. Tyler, I'm ready to wrap up. Is there anything else you want to add to the conversation? I just scrolled through and I think I covered everything I wanted to.
Yeah. The only thing I was surprised about tonight is that no one asked what light the beam meant.
I looked it up. Yeah.
I like the NBA, so I knew it too, but I was like, oh, someone's definitely going to be calling and being like, what the heck is light the beam? Why was that so over? So look it up if you want to, audience, but we'll leave it a mystery.
I was just thinking, what like social media trend did I not follow the last 4 days? And I'm like, oh, it's just a spotlight they shine when the NBA team in that building win a game. So
yeah.
Very good. All right, great. Tyler, just give a pitch for people now that they're wrapping up the podcast to go mm-hmm. see what you're doing over on the YouTube page.
Yeah. I mean, so, you know, if you like me here, check it out there for that reason. But if other reasons are Zach Haydorn, who we all know is great. Me and him do a weekly recap show on Thursday, so you can check that out if you're listening to this on Thursday. We do that at 4 p.m. Eastern time. We recap all the biggest news stories of the week in about an hour, hour and a half, and get you caught up. And then we also do preview shows for all the major wrestling shows, so talk about the card, what we expect to happen, interact with people live. So if you hit the bell notification and subscribe, you'll see when we go live every time. You can interact with myself, Zach Haydorn, and others as we talk about in preview matches for that night's card. And then we've also Stephanie Chase, who is based in the UK, focusing on AEW. So you can check out her content. She does quick 5-10 minute videos recapping you on what's going on. So if you're maybe not in love with AEW this time, you can watch her videos and get caught up and be a smart fan like the rest of us. And lots of other good stuff coming in the future. But yeah, usually content daily on there now. And for big events like WrestleMania and AEW pay-per-views, we do a lot of stuff around that as well. So, yeah, just check us out. Subscribe, like, hit that bell, all that good stuff. We appreciate your support.
Excellent. Thanks, everybody. If you haven't yet checked out the flagship I recorded with Zach Haydorn yesterday on our Blue Logo show, the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast, just search Wade Keller, subscribe to both, and go to YouTube and search Wade Keller and subscribe to that in addition to our PW Torch channel. Thanks to our emailers. We had some callers we didn't get to. I got wrapped up in emails, and then some of you guys dropped off, and I understand that everyone has 2 hours to hang out while we do that. But I appreciate also Ted, our on-site correspondent, and everybody who's listening. And we'll talk to you next time, which here on the post show will be Friday night after, which would be a fun episode of SmackDown. Thanks, everybody.